This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. The second weekend of Jazz Fest kicks off 4 days of festivities beginning Thursday. We'll visit the Cultural Exchange Pavilion where Brazil takes center stage. Then we'll talk with jazz hero, Harold Batiste. And we'll travel to the shores of Ireland in a photo exhibit that highlights hidden jewels. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. There's a new cultural element in this year's Jazz Fest. Eileen Fleming reports organizers concentrated on showing off ties between New Orleans and Brazil.
Jazz Fest Cultural Exchange Pavilion coordinator Valerie Guillet says the two regions have much in common.
These are really manifested in music, in parades, in carnival, in a lot of different ways. It's like cousins, very far apart geographically, but amazingly similar culturally.
Historically, Brazil was influenced by European nations, had a major sugarcane industry, and was part of the African slave trade. What evolved are lively carnival parades, dancers in elaborate costumes, and vibrant and diverse urban neighborhoods. Images from Rio de Janeiro's communities called favelas are on display for visitors. Erica Tamka coordinated the photo exhibit at the pavilion. There are 24 images displayed along a ring attached to the ceiling. She says many people have the idea that favelas are slums, but the pictures show a beauty in their daily life. The pictures are taken by residents in a project called The People's Image. She points out one of her favorites.
Well, I can start with that one, which I like very much. The kids, the old girls, they jump in. I don't know if you have this game, you know, with a rope.
Jump rope.
Jump rope.
Jump rope.
Yeah. So it's quite nice. You don't see the rope in this particular photo, but that's what they're doing. And even though you don't have the faces or the heads, I think it's quite interesting because you can feel this atmosphere of the game, of the playing, and the kids.
Two graffiti artists are on their first visit to New Orleans, where they will be creating an image on both sides of a panel erected to the side of the pavilion. Through interpreter Anna Powell, they say they have no idea what they will be creating. It depends on what they see here.
Nosso trabalho tem tá muito envolvido com improviso. É até uma temática muito frequente na comunidade.
So they work by improvising. So the themes come from the community basically.
O próprio Brasil, né?
A improvisação
que brasileira de
The improvisation is something that's very Brazilian.
Set in a corner of the pavilion are the cardboard creations of Sergio Cesar, who's been creating favela models from recycled materials for 30 years. In the middle of one project he's making at Jazz Fest, a New Orleans shotgun stands out, in yellow, with a bit of discarded fan standing in for iron lacework. Again, through interpreter Powell.
He said that starting by knowing that Louis Armstrong is from here, he also mentioned that
do Katrina,
seeing how the city is recovering after Katrina. And he thinks it's related to his work because what he does is he builds things. So it's relating that to the rebuilding of the city. He's saying it's a pleasure to be here.
Jazz Fest cultural spokesman Guillet says the artists selected for the cultural exchange are not the big stars of Brazil, and that was done on purpose.
We bring people that may not be known, but that are very talented and that are not seen very often in the U.S. So most of them have actually never traveled to the U.S.
Brazilian music is being performed on stages throughout the fairgrounds, as well as throughout the day in the cultural pavilion. For WWNO's Inside the Arts, I'm Eileen Fleming.
You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO. I'm Diane Mack. Producer of top 40 hits, saxophonist, composer, educator, New Orleans native Harold Batiste is all these things. And now, he's been named a jazz hero. WWNO's Fred Kasten picks up the story.
Top 40 hits were among the furthest things from Harold Batiste's mind when he, Ellis Marsalis, and drummer Edward Blackwell hit the highway for Los Angeles in 1956. They were heading west to find work as jazz musicians, but the jazz pickings in L.A. turned out to be kind of slim.
We just had one little gig. We had one gig once a week at a place called, I forgot, it was a Mexican place. It paid about $12 or something. It was just so we could play, that's all.
Harold Batiste eventually landed a deal to work as an artist in repertoire, A&R man, what we now call a producer, for Specialty Records, which was owned by Art Roop.
It was just fun to him. He was a rich cat, you know, he was an oil man. Mm-hmm. And the Specialty Records was just something he loved to do. And he loved gospel music, see. He had a lot of gospel groups. He had the Soul Stirrers and all that. So that's the way he perceived, you know, the realm of black music was through gospel.
Through gospel.
And it, or either like Little Richard.
Art Roop's limited perspective on black music was to lead to one of the legendary bonehead plays in recording history. One of Specialty's artists was Sam Cooke, who wanted to make the move from gospel to pop. And Harold Batiste's first assignment for Specialty was to work out an arrangement under the supervision of Specialty's chief A&R man, Bumps Blackwell, for Sam Cooke to record You Send Me at a session that was going great until Art Roop showed up and called it to a halt.
When he heard Sam singing soft and pretty, and I had these girls, I had written some music off of them to sing behind him, music, a little pretty stuff, he has flipped and put them all out, sent them home. And you know, the next day he offered Bumps, he said, if you think this is so great, you can have these masters. You know, instead of he owed Bumps about $10,000. He said, and I don't owe you nothing. So Bumps took the mess. Bumps said, I'll take them. And went down to a cat who was starting the record label named Bob Keane. And so the record came out on Keane Records. I guess they consider the rest is history. And boy, Art was crying. He called me up and said, Bat, we're in mourning up here. We're in mourning. I said, well, you know, he said, I'm really ignorant, man. That was prejudice of me. I mean, in my own mind, I could not imagine him singing nothing sweet and pretty like that, you know. Honest you do.
Whenever I'm with you. Harold Batiste's main job for Specialty was to sign and record New Orleans area artists for the label, which kept him back and forth between L.A. and the Crescent City for the next few years. And by 1960, he had formulated a plan to start a label of his own. The idea was to put together a group of musician investors who would own the company and serve as its house band. Trumpeter Melvin Lasty was the first to come aboard and gave the company its name, All for One, or AFO. Bassist Chuck Beatty, guitarist Roy Montrell, drummer John Boudreau, and saxophonist Red Tyler soon join in, and AFO Incorporated in 1961. Then scored a million seller with its second release, Barbara George's I Know. That success allowed Harold Batiste to pursue his primary cultural mission with AFO, which was to document, on record, the prodigious, but to that point largely unheralded, modern jazz chops of such New Orleans artists as Ellis Marsalis, Ed Blackwell, Alvin Batiste, Nat Parolat, and James Black. Larger labels began to raid the AFO roster, however, and after a distributor made off with most of the I Know profits, Harold Batiste decided to mothball the recording side of AFO and head back to L.A., to pitch a new community-oriented project to Sam Cooke.
There was a lot of talent, I thought, in down in the what they call Central City, which was Watson and everything down there in the black community, there was a lot of talent that I felt that never got to Hollywood where they could peddle their stuff. And even when they did, they were intimidated. They didn't really. So I went to Sam with the idea of saying, man, you know, we ought to have some kind of way that they could have a place in the community for people to come and get their stuff together before they, you know, so, and then show them how to get out here. And I said, well, you know, call them something like soul stations, you know, where people can come and get their stuff together. And he really went for it. So we, you know, he financed it. Me and Melvin went on out and found a place out on Vermont Avenue and opened up the soul station.
Sam Cooke's death in late 1964 would ultimately lead to the demise of the Soul Stations project, but not before Harold Batiste reconnected with one of his former Specialty Records colleagues, Sonny Bono.
I had the Soul Station going with Sam, and by that time he hadn't met Cher, and he was working for Phil Spector at the time, and Phil knew me too because I had done something with him before he went out there. So they started hiring me to play piano on some of Phil Spector's stuff. And Sonny was singing background and going to get coffee for Phil Spector. And Cher was just hanging around, a groupie. But he came by the association with Cher and said, look, this, you know, she wants to do this and do that. And her father's going, uncle or somebody had $40,000 he was going to put in to get her started. So he asked me what I do, you know, would I help him get a record together.
Harold Batiste wrote arrangements for the first two Sonny and Cher releases, but did not work with him in the studio on those sessions. Then,
when Sonny wrote I Got You, Babe, the song, he brought it by my house over on Mansfield Avenue, and he said, man, this is going to be it. This is it, you know, man. You know, this is, you know. And Cher was, and she believed that it was going to be a good song. So, you know, I put together the music and stuff like that and found out what ideas he did have. And the way he sang it to me, that's why I got the idea of the bassoon and the oboe playing a little doop, 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 that kind of stuff like that.
I got you, babe. I got you, babe. They say I love.
Harold Batiste arranged and co-produced four Sonny and Cher hits in the mid-60s, did some film score work, served as music director for two seasons of the Sonny and Cher television show, and worked with transplanted New Orleanian Mac Rebenack to develop the Dr. John persona, and record three essential Dr. John albums, Gree Gree, Babylon, and Gumbo. It was also in California that Harold Batiste met one of the most esteemed 20th century composers.
I met Stravinsky one time. When I met him, I was excited because I loved Igor Stravinsky. But when he met me and found out I was from New Orleans, he was excited about me.
Right.
What? Oh, you from New Orleans? And he told me about, you know, all the European composers were trying to learn how to write that kind of music y'all making. They thought this was the music of the future.
Harold Batiste came back to New Orleans in 1989 to help create that music of the future, teaming with Ellis Marsalis to build the jazz studies program at UNO from startup to international prominence, and launching the Next Generation Band. Harold Batiste will receive the New Orleans chapter of the Jazz Journalists Association's 2014 Jazz Hero Award tomorrow night at the Prime Example Restaurant and Jazz Club. The 6:30 p.m. ceremonies will be followed by a concert of Harold Batiste's music by the Next Generation Big Band. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Gaston.
And now we travel across the pond through the magic of photography. My next guest is Irish art and nature photographer Dara Muldowney. He has been on a journey photographing Ireland's rock pools at low tide. His fine art prints are the subject of a traveling exhibit, Jewelry Box, Ireland's Hidden Gems, now on view in the French Quarter at the Irish Cultural Museum of New Orleans. The exhibit highlights largely unexplored areas of the Emerald Isle. Photographer Daramil Downey joins us now. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Hi, Diane. Thanks a million. It's great to be here.
You are displaying a very colorful exhibit of abstract shots of nature, specifically rock pools. Just what are rock pools, and how did your journey along the coast of Ireland begin?
Well, rock pools are, as a lot of Americans would refer to them, as tidal pools. They are this magical window, if you like, between the tides. So the tide will come in at the coast. When the tide goes back out again, the water pools around the rocks, and it continuously pools, which enables life and seaweeds and anemones and all sorts of creatures and wonderful hidden gems to be seen.
So these gems are not just stones.
It's a metaphor. It's how it makes me feel, I suppose. When I stare into these shimmering pools, it's like looking into a treasure trove. And it could be in the shape of shells or anemones or limpets or barnacles or just the seaweed being caught and backlit or shimmering light being speckled over the floor of the rock pool. These, to me, are all gems and beauty in themselves. So I see it as jewelry for the soul.
So tell us, where exactly did your journey take you and how long was the trip?
I started in Wicklow and I made sure I hit every single coastal county, there's 17 of them. It took me 9 weeks to do it, and I did it all in a Volkswagen camper van, a 1986 model, which I call Wanda. So it enabled me to be free and allow me for full immersion in what I was doing. It's very important to me to, if you like, enter a wave of consciousness when I do my work so that I will lose myself in it and I'm kind of, I am totally absorbed in what I do. And that's, I think, some of the strength of my work is because I'm so connected to what I'm doing.
So tell us about your technique and what you were looking to capture in these rock pools.
My whole work, I suppose, from the day I started getting into nature photography has been a pursuit in beauty. I would have then had that approach, but then I sat down with a marine biologist afterwards and got told what I was looking at. I mean, I have one image which I call Pals with a question mark, and it's a picture of two anemones side by side, and when I was looking at them I thought, oh, it's not so cute, they're having a little hug, you know. And it turns out, the marine biologist filled me in, that they're actually in the middle of a slow motion fight vying for the feeding hotspot, and eventually one of them will win and the other one will move off. So I wanted it to be, so I'm into abstract nature. I'm into showing up a lot of the less often viewed imagery. So it all will come to a kind of sensual, but, you know, drinking the colour experience of what you see.
What type of camera did you use?
So on this project, I use a Canon A1. It's a 35-year-old camera, so it's all analogue. I shoot with colour side film, Fuji Provia 100 ISO. I use a tripod because it's macro lens, so I had to use a tripod for that to have stillness. However, the water on the surface, even on calm days, would prove to have a little bit of movement. So you'd be waiting and waiting for gusts to pass, and you'd be just there with your cable release, holding. Okay, now, take the shot.
Wow. You have to have a lot of patience to do that.
You do, but, you know, I never found, like, that it was patience I needed for this, because every moment is so beautiful that, you know, you're just feeling fortunate and grateful for where you are and being shown by nature such beautiful things.
When did your interest in photography begin?
It began reasonably close to here because I did a scuba dive course over in Crystal River in Florida in 1992. So I did that and I was flying on this new planet. And I came to the surface almost blubbering, going, that was just amazing. I want to capture it. How do I do this? You know? So I had this defining moment of wanting to photograph. And I started wanting to photograph the underwater world. But, you know, I figured, right, well, I'll get myself a camera and learn how to use it. So I got an SLR, learned how to use it, self-taught. And, you know, I started realizing there's lots of stuff above water as well. I mean, maybe now this journey back into the rock pools is a step back into going underwater again.
So you're pretty much an ambassador for Ireland through your work.
The exhibition has traveled to New York. It's traveled to Atlanta, Boston, Chicago. It was in Dubai and Berlin. And now it's here in New Orleans. And next year it's going to Mexico.
What are you hoping folks will remember most about this exhibit?
to be mindful of each moment and to let moments not pass them by, so that they take note of things that are around them on a continual basis, day to day.
Dara, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Diane. It's been a real pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on.
Photographer Dara Muldowney's exhibit, Jewelry Box, Ireland's Hidden Gems, is on display at the Irish Cultural Museum of New Orleans, 933 Conti Street, through the end of May. The museum is open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. You can also see more of Dara Muldowney's work at Dulra, D-U-L-R-A, photography.com. And we have something extra in our Lanyap Corner. Are you in the mood for a little reggae? The iconic reggae band The Wailers are keeping the memory of Bob Marley alive as they kick off their U.S. tour with a stop at Jazz Fest on Thursday, May 1st. They will perform at the Congo Square stage, 4:25 p.m. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.